The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Great to see you here. I don't know if you ever read anything by P.J. O'Rourke, the American political commentator. Very, very funny man. He would be, he's a Republican, but he's also quoted as saying, the Republicans are the party that says government doesn't work, and then they get elected and prove it. In 2005, after the election of George W. Bush, he gave an address where he's not a Christian, but he walked through the Ten Commandments. Let me read you very quickly what he said. And then he concluded, there's the tenth commandment. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbour's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbour's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, or his ass, or anything that is thy neighbour's. Why would God, with just 10 things to tell Moses, choose one of these things about jealousy, about the mansion with the in-ground pool next door? Yet think how important the tenth commandment is to a community, to a nation, indeed to a presidential election. If you want a mule, if you want a pot roast, if you want a cleaning lady, don't be a jerk and whine about what the people across the road have. Go and get your own. The Tenth Commandment sends a message to all the jerks who want redistribution of wealth, higher taxes, more government programs, more government regulation, more government, less free enterprise, and less freedom. And the message is clear and concise. Go to hell. Now, there's P.J. O'Rourke putting the boot into all those lazy, envious socialists. Is that what the Tenth Commandment does? You shall not covet? Or what about the other side of the economic political divide? So here we have P.J. O'Rourke. Gordon Gekko, if you want a statement about greed, you may remember, in Wall Street. The first one was great. The second one, they should have hired a scriptwriter, but that's another story. Gordon Gekko said this. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed is good. For lack of a better word, greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Is he right? Well, another quote from someone even more famous. Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. Jesus of Nazareth, Luke chapter 12. And there's Jesus putting the boot into those greedy capitalists and tells a very profound a parable of the rich fool. So which is it? Is the Bible critiquing the coveting side of socialism or the greed that drives capitalism? And as you might suspect, the Bible critiques both, but it's not money and possessions that's the heart of the problem. The Bible, and particularly Jesus, gets through to the real heart of the problem, the heart that can be a problem with the socialist or the capitalist or anyone in the middle. So this morning, I'm going to rush through. I'm sure you'll get it, though, on the way through. You'll understand. I want to look at what's the difference between coveting and greed. Do they really do that much harm anyway? And what's Jesus' alternative? So we've been working our way through the Ten Commandments. And you get to the Tenth Commandment, and P.J. O'Rourke just read it for us. You shall not covet your neighbour's house. You shall not covet your neighbour's wife, or his manservant, his maidservant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything else that belongs to your neighbour. It seems like you could be forgiven for thinking the Ten Commandments end with a kind of a whimper. You've got the big ones like don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, yeah, bang, 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 and then don't covet. Like, what's that all about? Well, let's see. It's anything but a whimper at the end, but let's see if we can unravel that. To put it in context, if you haven't been here the last few weeks, we've been working our way through and looking at the Ten Commandments. About 1400 BC, the Bible tells us that God brought the nation of Israel out of slavery in Egypt. He makes them his people and then brings them to Mount Sinai and then tells them how they should respond, how they should live with him as their God. There's different ways of dividing up the Ten Commandments. You can divide it up this way. The first three are about relationship with God. So worship only the true God. Don't use images to worship him. Know him through his word. Be careful how you carry or use the name of God. And then the next seven, 4 through to 10, are about the way to treat your fellow human being in order for society to work properly. Rules for a healthy society. We've been through all of these over the last 7 or 8 weeks. Remember the Sabbath day, the importance of rest, honour your father and mother, do not murder, do not commit adultery, do not steal, do not tell lies, And today, the last of all, do not covet. Now, what's interesting, I've said it again and again, when God looks at wants a healthy society, he doesn't give them a bill of rights. What he gives them is a list of obligations to other people. And what you may also notice is there's no penalties associated with the Ten Commandments. It just says, basically, do it. Now, the theologians call this apodictic law. It's the idea that these laws, I'll quote, refer to a timeless and divine command, not to the law applied. In other words, this is obviously clearly true as revealed by God, therefore you should do it. Nahum Sarna is a Jewish scholar, and I'll quote him on this. He says, the Ten Commandments declare that there are certain God-given values and behavioural norms that are absolute. Morality is the expression of the divine will. The motivation for observing the law is not fear of punishment, but the desire to conform to the will of God. The Decalogue, Ten Commandments, thus becomes a self-enforcing code in its appeal to the conscience and not to enlightened self-interest, and its enforcing mechanism is spiritual discipline and the moral fibre of the individual and not the threat of penalty that is imposed by the coercive power of the state. That's apodictic law. Now, when you drill down to the lower sections of the law in the Bible, in the Old Testament, there's casuistic law, as they say, case by case, and there's a fair bit of coercive power in the case-by-case law. But the Ten Commandments are different. What we've also shown is the Ten Commandments come early in the Bible, and they're like a seed that's planted and then that grows. And they're given, most of the Ten Commandments are given in the negative, and then particularly in the teachings of Jesus, Jesus will give you the full orbed, or the, how can I put it, the full blossom of what it should look like. I'll show you, I'm sure you'll get it. So the commandments, do not murder, do not commit adultery, do not steal. By the time you get to the New Testament and the teachings of Jesus, do not murder becomes love your neighbour, even love your enemy. Do not commit adultery becomes faithfulness with body and heart and eyes. Do not steal turns into be generous. Last week we saw do not lie becomes speak the truth. And today, do not covet. Well, that's what we're going to work on for the next little bit. What is coveting? It's a word you'll hear occasionally, but not generally in use. So there's the commandment, do not covet your neighbour's house, etc., etc. The Hebrew word in the Old Testament, hamad, just means desire. The idea is that you want something, desire. And also, when you go through to the New Testament, the same word they use, it means desire, and it's a neutral word. So Jesus can say to his disciples, I desire to eat the Passover with you. At the same time, in the context, you can work out when are the New Testament writers talking about coveting. Our English word covet. Let me go back here. I missed that slide. Our English word covet, the definition, to yearn to possess something, especially something belonging to another. Coveting, to yearn to possess something, especially something belonging to another. So the idea of coveting is, I want what's yours. Now, greed is very close to the idea, but in the New Testament, greed's always negative. The word is never neutral. Greed just seems to be, I want more stuff. If I just have more stuff, particularly more stuff than you, I'll be happier, I'll be more secure, I'll feel more important. So coveting, or the desire word, is kind of neutral, and you work out from the context. Greed is always about, I want more. Now, the last commandment is different to the others, because in the 10th commandment, you move from, the others are all about action. In the 10th commandment, you move from action to attitudes, or from deeds to desires. But you can see how the 10th commandment could actually drive breaking all of the others. The desire for more, and particularly the desire of wanting your stuff, would actually drive all of these. So I won't go into it in detail, but you can see the idea of I want more and more and more will lead you to break the fourth commandment about we won't rest. Honour your father and mother. Mark chapter 7, Jesus says the religious leaders of the day didn't care for their parents properly. Why? Because it cost money and was inconvenient. The sixth commandment, you shall not murder. You can see how the desire for more can drive people to that, or particularly to anger and frustration. The seventh commandment, don't commit adultery. the 10th commandment particularly says, don't covet your neighbour's wife, husband, partner. Do not steal. Easy to see how that plugs into wanting more. And then don't tell, don't give false testimony, the idea of lie and cheat, etc., to get more. How does it fit into the first commandment? We'll see in just a moment. So let me walk you through, on the outline you'll see points A through to D. Let me walk you through why it is that God says to his people, do not covet, do not want what other people want. So some of the consequences, competition and envy. In the book of Ecclesiastes, in the Old Testament, King Solomon says, and I saw that all toil and all achievements spring from one person's envy of another. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. He's saying all our efforts and efforts and energies, etc., spring from envy and competition of other people. It is interesting, isn't it, that wage negotiations don't happen on the basis of what does a person need. It's all about wage relativities. Wage relativities is how much have I got compared to you. Well, have you noticed we never tell each other what we actually earn? How would it be at work, at your workplace, if on your name tag or your swipe card you had, you know, Al Stewart and your salary? Okay? Why is it we don't do that? You might like to have a think about that. And so people compete against one another, and then nations compete against one another, and there's tariffs and potential trade wars, and it's envy and competition. Second point, discontentment. So Ecclesiastes again. Whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. This too is meaningless. About a month or so ago, BRW Rich List, not BRW anymore, it's the Australian Financial Review magazine, AFR, Rich List came out, the richest 200 people in Australia. So I thought I'd go and buy it. I'm such a cheapskate, I now find out it's all available online. I wasted $5 buying the magazine, but anyway. And so who's featuring this year? Well, Clive Palmer came in at number 20. It's good to see a battler do well, I think, to be back in the charts. James Packer was number 10. Frank Lowy, number 5. Hui Wang Mao in the property market came in at $9 billion and was 4th. Gina Reinhart, 3rd. Harry Triguboff, 2nd. And Australia's richest man or richest family, Anthony Pratt, number 1, $12.9 billion. Why do you think AFR prints that year by year? I reckon they sell more than 200 copies. It's not just that Gina goes out and buys a copy to see where she rated. We're fascinated with the rich. And do they have enough? I guess that's for them to answer, isn't it? It is interesting, though, that we have about three times the GDP per person that we had in the 1950s, and it still doesn't seem to be enough. I have pornography delivered to my place every week, whether I want it or not. I don't mean sex pornography, I mean real estate pornography in the local papers. And real estate agents selling us what was sold in the local market, and it's all about helping us to be discontent. Let me go to pain. Printed out on your program, on the left-hand side, is the Apostle Paul writing to Timothy, his young lieutenant, and talking about the damage that coveting or the drive to be rich can do. You notice chapter 6, verse 10 there? He says, for the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Over stress, work, punishing work hours, health issues, family breakdowns, dishonesty, corruption. It's all driven by the need or the desire for more and more and more. You know, there's one lady I know who the family would be multi-millionaires, own multiple properties. She doesn't need to work. She can have overseas trips, anything she wants. And yet she lives in discontent, anger, pain, frustration. Why? Because other members of the family may get more share of the business than they deserve. Or she thinks she won't get more than them. You notice it's not money that's the problem, it's the love of money. And finally, eternity. What we desire, what is at the centre of our life is actually our functional God. That's why Jesus talks about money so often. So the Apostle Paul in the book of Ephesians says, "For of this you can be sure, no immoral, impure or greedy person, such a person is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ or God." You see how it actually relates to the first commandment. If money or wealth or whatever is what ultimately we desire, it's what it becomes our functional God. And Jesus is saying, or the Apostle Paul is saying, if that's the case, it will actually stop you knowing the true God or stop you being in his kingdom. As Jesus said, what good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? And so what's the alternative that Jesus gives to having this false God? Well, here's the thing, remember, do not lie, become speak the truth, and do not covet. Jesus is always on about finding contentment. Have a look at on your program, 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 6. It says this, "But godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we'll be content with that." I don't think I'm there yet. I certainly haven't learnt verse 8. But you imagine the freedom to actually be able to say, I have enough and I'm content and I know that my Creator will care for me. To be able to say that really does set us free. It's not to say that you can't be ambitious, but I think I've been thinking about this. If you're content, can you be ambitious? Yes. But it's worth asking the question of, why am I ambitious, or what am I ambitious for, or for whom am I ambitious? It's the why, the who, the how questions that are worth asking about ambition. The next one, generosity as an alternative. Look at chapter 6, verse 17. He says, "Command those who are rich in this present world," and then we'll go to verse 18. "Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share." The way to show who your master is, are you able to actually give money away, to give wealth away, to be generous? There was a Oxfam study in 2016 where they concluded, I'm not sure exactly how they worked this out, but it'd be probably reasonably close, that the richest 62 people in the world own as much as the bottom half of the world economically. So the richest 62 own about the same amount as the poorest 3 billion. Now, it's not wrong to own possessions. It's not wrong to be wealthy at all. But I couldn't help but think, imagine the difference that those 62 could make to planet Earth if they were really generous. Now, I think Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are starting to get with the program and they're making a difference. But imagine if the other 60 kicked in. What about ordinary people? If you'll forgive the expression. Well, the Queensland University of Technology did a study in 2016 on the number of Australians who claimed tax-deductible donations for giving to charities, etc. They found that 80% of the adult population claimed deductions for charity giving. The average donation across the year was $764, which is 1%, about 1% of income. But the interesting statistic was this. There were 6,600 people who earned more than $1 million that year. And 41% of them claimed nothing back in terms of charitable giving. So 41% of those who earned more than $1 million claimed nothing back. Some people are generous and some people aren't. And finally, eternity. Here's the interesting thing. You see, Paul says to Timothy about command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they'll lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. It's not that you'll buy your way into heaven, but as Jesus teaches again and again, what we do with our money shows who our God really is. And Jesus promised, the Apostle Paul here says, that as you spend your money according to the way Jesus would have us do it, if you trust him and we're generous to people, God will reward you. It's actually like investing in eternity. or as Jesus put it, treasure in heaven. And so the most precious jewel of all, contentment. To be able to say, I have enough. I have enough and my Creator will care for me and I'll live for Him rather than the stuff that He's given me. All right, time to pull up very quickly. I think it's useless to say to an audience, stop coveting. Really, why? Because it's about desires, and I don't think we can just switch desires off. It's interesting that Jesus talks about desire in the sense it gives us something bigger and better to desire, which is why he always talks about the kingdom of God and being able to actually see God at work in the world and where that leads. And we're very easily, though, driven by our desires. This quote has been attributed to many figures in history. This one was to Thomas Cranmer. He may have said it. What the heart loves, the will chooses, and the mind justifies. And don't you think that's right? We're not just rational. It's what we desire or love drives us, and then the will and the mind just play catch-up. What can we say? The Ten Commandments, written in stone? Well, obviously they're meant to last. But I think I can say, it's not irreverent to say this, the Ten Commandments written in stone, they didn't change people. They didn't change people 1400 BC, and they don't change people today. But the promise of God was this, that with the coming of Jesus, he would not write the law or write his way to live on stone, but actually write it on people's hearts to move them to want to obey him. So in the New Testament, the book of Hebrews chapter 10 quotes one of the promises from the Old Testament. It says this, "This is the covenant I will make with them after that time, says the Lord. I will put my laws in their hearts and I will write them on their minds." And so what's the promise? That God will actually change people to want to know him, to want to trust him, to want to live his way. And the great news of the New Testament is that through the person of Jesus, if we ask God to do that for us, he will. How much of the modern idolization, perhaps idolatry, of money results from the lack of an identity outside of your job or bank balance? People seem to have no identity beyond their work, money, sex, etc. Yes, I think certainly in many cases that's true. I think the way that we're wired up, what we look for is, if you like, status and significance and security. We want to feel important and we want to feel safe. Depending on the different genders, it's more important. I think generally, might be a little bit of a cliche, but generally people would say women look more to security and safety is very important, men to status. That'll vary between people, but that tends to be the way. And so what it is that gives you your status and security will become what you worship, what you live for in the Bible's terms. And so, yeah, we live in a society where, for example, the job that you have becomes who you are and you find your status and security in that. Or it may well be in your bank balance. Once again, what happens is we so easily we take good things and we turn them into God things. Or we take good gifts from our Creator and turn them into ultimate things. So work is something good. We're wired up to work. If you can enjoy your work, the Bible says it's a gift of God. It's a great thing. And use your gifts as a way of caring for other people, etc. The problem comes when you start making that the meaning of life, because it dishonours our Creator and it won't take the weight that we put on it. Same thing about money or really anything else. So, yeah, an idol is your functional God, what gives you significance and security, the ultimate thing. Someone writes, "What happens if I am a very coveting person?" Speaking to a room full of lawyers, how could that possibly be? Clergy are just the same, believe me. What happens if I'm a very coveting person? Should I pray to stop coveting? Yes. Should I pray to not act on my coveting? Yes. Should I pray for a spirit of generosity to replace my coveting? I think that's the one. So the person asked three questions like that. It is interesting that when the Apostle Paul talks about desires, etc., in Philippians chapter 4, he doesn't say, don't think about all the bad things. He says, if anything is good and true and honourable, think about those things. So it's the idea of trying to fill your head with the positives, and particularly, I think, yes, to ask for a spirit of generosity. In many ways, generosity is its own reward. Jesus says it's better to give than to receive, and it really is. Right? It's a great joy in being able to give to people and good causes. Now, this one's a harder question. Does covet of what someone else, does covet of what someone else has mean that you want the same as that person, i.e. to keep up with the Joneses, or that you want the thing at the expense of the other person? Interesting question. I'm not sure that you can tell exactly from the 10th commandment. To want the same thing as that person to keep up with the Joneses, I think, would fall into the greed category. It seems like greed is the generic idea of, I want more, and if I have more, I'll have more status and I'll have more security and life will be better. That's the greed. The coveting is the desire that I want what you have. And it's not hard to see, I guess, how there can be a thing of, I want what you have, can easily become, I want you what you have, even at your expense. So you can see how that's the, if you like, the, let me go back. You can see how that, I want what you have, easily turns into damaging the other person. And it's certainly the opposite of contentment where we'll find peace. And so, as a fellow coveter, and I'll admit to that, to actually pray that God might change our hearts to make us truly content and generous is a great way to find peace.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.